Me? Yes, you, said Willie impatiently. Up or I'll kick your ass. William's back itched between the shoulder blades as they entered the camp. Colenso crouched like a monkey on his horse's back, holding the flag as low as he dared, and muttering strange oaths in Cornish. William's left hand itched too, wanting to go for the hilt of his sword, the handle of his pistol. But he'd come unarmed. If they meant to shoot him, they'd shoot him, armed or not. And to come unarmed was a sign of good faith. So he put back his cloak, in spite of the snow, to show his lack of weapons, and rode slowly into the storm. The preliminaries went well. No one shot him, and he was directed to a Colonel Preston, a tall, ragged man in the remnants of a continental uniform, who had eyed him askance, but listened with surprising courtesy to his request. Permission was granted, but this being the American army, the permission granted was not license to take the surgeon away, but rather license to ask the surgeon if he would go. Willie left Colenso with the horses and mule with strict instructions to keep his eyes open, and made his way up the little hill where he had been told Denzel Hunter likely was. His heart was beating fast, and not only from the exertion. In Philadelphia, he had been sure Hunter would come at his request. Now, he wasn't quite so sure. He had fought Americans, knew a great many of them, who were in no respect different from the Englishmen they'd been 2 years previous, but he'd never walked through an American army camp before. It seemed chaotic, but all camps did in their early stages, and he was able to perceive the rough order that did in fact exist among the piles of debris and butchered tree stumps. But there was something very different about the feel of this camp, something almost exuberant. The men he passed were ragged in the extreme. Not one in ten had shoes despite the weather, and groups of them huddled like beggars around the bonfires, wrapped in blankets, shawls, the remnants of canvas tents and burlap sacks. And yet they didn't huddle in miserable silence. They talked. Conversed amiably, telling jokes, arguing, getting up to piss in the snow, to stamp round in circles to get the blood going. He'd seen a demoralised camp before, and this one wasn't. Which was, all things considered, amazing. He assumed Denzel Hunter must share this spirit. That being so, would he consent to leave his fellows? No way to tell, save by asking. There was no door to knock on. He came round a stand of leafless oak saplings that had so far escaped the axe, and found Hunter crouched on the ground, sewing up a gash in the leg of a man who lay before him on a blanket. Rachel Hunter held the man's shoulders, her capped head bent over him as she spoke encouragingly to him. "Did I not tell thee he was quick?" she was saying. "No more than 30 seconds," I said. "And so it has been. I counted it out, did I not?"
"Thee counts in a most leisurely fashion, Rachel," the doctor said, smiling as he reached for his scissors and clipped the thread. "A man might walk 3 times around St. Paul's in 1 of your minutes."
"Stuff," she said mildly. "'Tis done in any case. Here, sit thee up and take some water. Thee does not—" She had turned toward the bucket that sat beside her, and as she did so, perceived William standing there. Her mouth opened in shock, and then she was up and flying across the clearing to embrace him. He hadn't expected that, but was delighted, and returned the embrace with great feeling. She smelled of herself and of smoke, and it made his blood run faster.
"Friend William, I never thought to see thee again," she said, stepping back with glowing face. "What does thee here? For I think thee has not come to enlist," she added, looking him up and down.
"No," he said, rather gruffly. "I have come to beg a favour. From your brother," he added, a little belatedly.
"Oh, come then, he is nearly finished."
She led him to Denny, still looking up at him in great interest.
"So thee is indeed a British soldier," she remarked. "We thought thee must be, but feared thee might be a deserter. I am pleased thee is not."
"Are you?" he asked, smiling. "But surely you would prefer that I abjure my military service and seek peace?" Of course I would that thee should seek peace, and find it too, she said matter-of-factly. But thee cannot find peace in oath-breaking and illegal flight, knowing thy soul steeped in deceit and fearing for thy life. Denny, look who has come.
Yes, I saw. Friend William, well met.
Dr. Hunter helped his freshly bandaged patient to his feet and came toward William, smiling.
Did I hear thee would ask a favour of me? If it is my power to grant it, it is thine.
I won't hold you to that, William said, smiling, and feeling a knot relax at the base of his neck. But hear me out, and I hope you will see fit to come. As he had half expected, Hunter was at first hesitant to leave the camp. There weren't many surgeons, and with so much illness due to the cold and the crowded conditions, it might be a week or more before he could return to camp. But William wisely kept silence, only glancing once at Rachel, and then meeting Denzel's eyes straight on.
Would you have her stay here through the winter?
Thee wishes Rachel to come with me?
Hunter asked, instantly divining his meaning.
I will come with thee whether he wishes it or not, Rachel pointed out, and both of you know it perfectly well.
Yes, said Denzel mildly, but it seemed mannerly to ask. Besides, it is not only a matter of thy coming, it...
William didn't hear the end of his sentence, for a large object was thrust suddenly between his legs from behind, and he emitted an unmanly yelp and leapt forward, whirling round to see who had assaulted him in this cowardly fashion.
Yes, I was forgetting the dog, Rachel said, still composed. He can walk now, but I doubt he can manage the journey to Philadelphia on foot. Can thee make shift to transport him, does thee think?
He recognised the dog at once. There couldn't possibly be two like him.
Surely this is Ian Murray's dog, he asked, putting out a tentative fist for the enormous beast to sniff. Where is his master?
The hunters exchanged a brief glance, but Rachel answered readily enough.
Scotland. He has gone to Scotland on an urgent errand with his uncle, James Fraser. Does thee know Mr. Fraser?
It seemed to William that both hunters were staring at him rather intently, but he merely nodded and said,
I met him once, many years ago. Why did the dog not go to Scotland with his master?
Again, that glance between them.
What was it about Murray, he wondered.
The dog was injured just before they took ship. Friend Ian was kind enough to leave his companion in my care, Rachel said calmly. Can thee procure a wagon, perhaps? I think thy horse may not like Rollo.
Lord John fitted the leather strap between Henry's teeth. The boy was half unconscious from a dose of laudanum, but knew enough still of his surroundings to give his uncle the bare attempt at a grin. Grey could feel the fright pulsing through Henry, and shared it. There was a ball of venomous snakes in his belly, a constant slithering sensation, punctuated by sudden stabs of panic. Hunter had insisted upon binding Henry's arms and legs to the bed, that there should be no movement during the operation. The day was brilliant. Sun coruscated from the frozen snow that rimmed the windows, and the bed had been moved to take best advantage of it. Dr. Hunter had been told of the dowser, but declined, courteously, to have the man come again, saying that this smacked of divination, and if he were to ask God's help in this endeavour, he thought he could not do so sincerely, were there anything of witchcraft about the process. That had rather affronted Mercy Woodcock, who puffed up a bit, but she kept silence, too glad and too anxious to argue. Grey was not superstitious, but was of a practical turn of mind, and had taken a careful note of the dowser's location of the ball he had found. He explained this, and with Hunter's reluctant assent, took out a small ruler and triangulated the spot on Henry's sunken belly, dabbing a bit of candle black on the place to mark it.
I think we are in readiness, Denzel said, and coming close to the bed, put his hands on Henry's head and prayed briefly for guidance and support for himself, for endurance and healing for Henry, and ended in acknowledging the presence of God among them. Despite his purely rational sentiments,
Gray felt a small lessening of the tension in the room and sat down opposite the surgeon, with the snakes in his belly, calmed for the moment. He took his nephew's limp hand in his and said calmly,
"Just hold on, Henry. I won't let go."
It was quick. Gray had seen army surgeons at work and knew their dispatch, but even by those standards, Denzel Hunter's speed and dexterity were remarkable. Gray had lost all sense of time, absorbed in the erratic clenching of Henry's fingers, the shrill keen of his screaming through the leather gag, and the doctor's movements, quickly brutal, then finicking, as he picked delicately, swabbed, and stitched. As the last stitches went in, Gray breathed for what seemed the first time in hours, and saw by the carriage clock on the mantel that barely a quarter of an hour had passed. William and Rachel Hunter stood by the mantelpiece out of the way, and he saw with some interest that they were holding hands, their knuckles as white as their faces. Hunter was checking Henry's breathing, lifting his eyelids to peer at his pupils, wiping the tears and snot from his face, touching the pulse under his jaw. Gray could see this, weak and irregular, but still pumping, a tiny blue thread beneath the waxen skin.
"Well enough, well enough, and thanks be to the Lord who has strengthened me," Hunter was murmuring. "Rachel, will thee bring me the dressings?"
Rachel at once detached herself from William and fetched the neat stack of folded gauze pads and torn linen strips, together with a glutinous mass of some sort, soaking green through the cloth that bound it.
"What is that?" Gray asked, pointing at it. "A poultice recommended to me by a colleague, a Mrs. Fraser. I have seen it to have laudable effects upon wounds of all kinds," the doctor assured him. "Mrs. Fraser?" Gray said, surprised. "Mrs. James Fraser? Where did you happen to encounter the lady?" "At Fort Ticonderoga," was the surprising answer. "She and her husband were with the Continental Army through the battles at Saratoga."
The snakes in Gray's belly roused abruptly.
"Do you mean to tell me that Mrs. Fraser is now at Valley Forge?"
"Oh, no."
Hunter shook his head, concentrated on his dressing.
"If thee will please lift him a little, friend Gray. I require to pass this bandage underneath. Ah, yes, exactly right. I thank thee."
"No," he resumed, straightening up and wiping his forehead, for it was very warm in the room with so many people and a blazing fire built up in the hearth. "No, the Frasers have gone to Scotland. Though Mr. Fraser's nephew was sufficiently kind as to leave us his dog," he added, as Rollo, made curious by the smell of blood, now rose from his spot in the corner and poked his nose under Gray's elbow. He sniffed interestedly at the splattered sheets up and down Henry's naked body. He then sneezed explosively, shook his head, and padded back to lie down where he promptly rolled onto his back and relaxed, paws in the air.
"Someone must remain with him for the next day or so,"
Hunter was saying, wiping his hands on a rag.
"He must not be left alone, lest he cease breathing. Friend William," he said, turning to Willie, "might it be possible to find a place for us to stay? I should be near for several days, so that I may call regularly to see how he progresses."
William assured him that this had already been taken care of. A most respectable inn, and here he glanced at Rachel, quite near at hand.
"Might he convey the Hunters there, or take Miss Rachel, if her brother should be not quite finished?"
It was apparent to Gray that Willie would like nothing better than a ride through the snow-sparkling city alone with this comely Quaker, but Mrs. Woodcock put a spoke in that wheel by observing that, in fact, it was Christmas. She had not had time or opportunity to make much of a meal, but would the gentleman and lady not honour her house and the day by taking a glass of wine to drink to Lieutenant Gray's recovery? This was generally agreed to as a capital idea, and Gray volunteered to sit with his nephew while the wine and glasses were being fetched. With so many people suddenly gone, the room felt much cooler, nearly cold, in fact, and Gray drew both sheet and coverlet gently up over Henry's bandaged stomach.
"You'll be all right, Henry," he whispered, though his nephew's eyes were closed.
and he thought the young man might be asleep.
Hoped he was.
But he wasn't. Henry's eyes slowly opened, his pupils showing the effect of the opium. His creased lids showed the pain that the opium couldn't touch.
No, I won't, he said in a weak, clear voice. He got only one. The second ball will kill me.
His eyes closed again as the sound of Christmas cheer came up the stairs. The dog sighed.
Rachel Hunter put one hand to her stomach, another to her mouth, and stifled a rising eructation.
Gluttony is a sin, she said, but one that carries its own punishment. I think I may vomit.
All sins do, her brother replied absently, dipping his pen. But thee's not a glutton. I saw thee eat.
But I am like to burst, she protested. And besides, I cannot help but think of the poor Christmas those we left at Valley Forge will make, by comparison with the decadence of our meal tonight.
Well, that is guilt, not gluttony, and false guilt at that. Thee ate no more than would constitute a normal meal. It is only that thee hasn't had one in months. And I think roast goose is perhaps not the uttermost word in decadence, even when stuffed with oysters and chestnuts. Now, had it been a pheasant stuffed with truffles, or a wild boar with a gilded apple in its mouth...
He smiled at her over his papers.
"Thee has seen such things?" she asked curiously.
"I have, yes. When I worked in London with John Hunter, he was much in society, and would now and then take me with him to attend a case, and sometimes to accompany him and his wife to some grand occasion. Most kind of him. But we must not judge, thee knows, most particularly by appearance. Even one who seems most frivolous, spendthrift, or light-minded, yet has a soul, and is valuable before God.
Yes, she said vaguely, not really attending.
She pulled back the curtain from the window, seeing the street outside as a white blur. There was a lantern hung by the inn's door that cast a small circle of light, but the snow was still falling. Her own face floated in the dark glass of the window, thin and big-eyed, and she frowned at it, pushing a straggle of dark hair back under her cap.
"Does thee think he knows?" she asked abruptly. "Friend William?"
"Does he know what?"
"His very striking resemblance to James Fraser," she said, letting the curtain fall. "Surely thee does not think this coincidence?"
"I think it is not our business."
Denny resumed scratching with his quill. She heaved an exasperated sigh. He was right, but that didn't mean she was forbidden to observe and to wonder. She'd been happy, more than happy, to see William again. And while his being a British soldier was no less than she had suspected, she had been extremely surprised to find him an officer of high rank. Much more than surprised to learn from his villainous-looking Cornish orderly that he was a lord, though the little creature had been uncertain what kind. Yet surely no two men could look so alike who did not share blood in some close degree. She had seen James Fraser many times, and admired him for his tall, straight dignity, thrilling a bit at the fierceness in his face, always feeling that niggle of recognition when she saw him. But it wasn't until William suddenly stepped out before her at the camp that she realized why. Yet how could an English lord be in any way related to a Scottish Jacobite, a pardoned criminal? For Ian had told her something of his own family history, though not enough. Not nearly enough.
"Thee is thinking of Ian Murray again," her brother observed, not looking up from his paper.
He sounded resigned.
"I thought thee abjured witchcraft," she said tartly. "Or does thee not include mind-reading among the arts of divination?"
"I notice thee does not deny it."
He looked up then, pushing his spectacles up his nose with a finger, the better to look through them at her.
"No, I don't deny it," she said, lifting her chin at him. "How did thee know, then?"
"Thee looked at the dog, and sighed in a manner betokening an emotion not usually shared between a woman and a dog."
"Hm," she said, disconcerted.
Well, what if I do think of him? Is that not my business either? To wonder how he does? What his family in Scotland makes of him? Whether he feels he has come home there?
Whether he will come back?
Denny took off his spectacles and rubbed a hand over his face. He was tired. She could see the day in his features.
He will come back, she said evenly. He would not abandon his dog.
That made her brother laugh, which annoyed her very much.
Yes, he will likely come back for the dog, he agreed. And if he comes back with a wife, Sissy?
His voice was gentle now, and she swung round to the window again to keep him from seeing that the question disturbed her. Not that he needed to see to know that.
It might be best for thee and for him if he did, Rachel.
Denny's voice was still gentle, but held a warning note.
Thee knows he is a man of blood.
What would thee have me do then? She snapped, not turning round. Marry William?
There was a brief silence from the direction of the desk.
William?
Denny said, sounding mildly startled.
Dost thee feel for him?
Of course I feel friendship for him, and gratitude, she added hastily.
So do I, her brother observed. Yet the thought of marrying him hadn't crossed my mind.
Thee is a most annoying person, she said crossly, turning round and glaring at him. Can thee not refrain from making fun of me for one day at least?
He opened his mouth to answer, but a sound from outside took her attention, and she turned again to the window, pulling back the heavy curtain. Her breath misted the dark glass, and she rubbed it impatiently with her sleeve in time to see a sedan chair below. The door of it opened, and a woman stepped out into the swirling snow. She was clad in furs, and in a hurry she handed a purse to one of the chair-bearers and rushed into the inn.
"Well, that is odd," Rachel said, turning to look first at her brother and then at the small clock that graced their rooms. Who goes a-visiting at 9 o'clock on Christmas night? It cannot be a friend, surely.
For friends didn't keep Christmas and would find the feast no bar to travel. But the Hunters had no connections, not yet, with the friends of any Philadelphia meeting. A thump of footsteps on the staircase prevented Denzel's reply, and an instant later the door of the room burst open. The furred-clad woman stood on the threshold, white as her furs.
"Denny," she said, in a strangled voice.
Her brother stood up as though someone had applied a hot coal to the seat of his breeches, upsetting the ink.
"Dorothea," he cried,
and in one bound had crossed the room and was locked in passionate embrace with the fur-clad woman. Rachel stood transfixed. The ink was dripping off the table onto the painted canvas rug, and she thought she ought to do something about that, but didn't. Her mouth was hanging open. She thought she ought to close it, and did. Quite suddenly, she understood the impulse that caused men to engage in casual blasphemy. Rachel picked up her brother's spectacles from the floor and stood holding them, waiting for him to disentangle himself.
Dorothea, she thought to herself. So this is the woman. But surely this is William's cousin.
For William had mentioned his cousin to her as they rode in from Valley Forge. Indeed, the woman had been in the house when Denny performed the operation on...
But then, Henry Gray must be this woman's brother.
She had hidden in the kitchen when Rachel and Denny came to the house this afternoon.
Why? Of course.
It wasn't squeamishness or fear, but a wish not to come face to face with Denny, and him on his way to perform a dangerous operation. She thought somewhat better of the woman for that, though she was not yet disposed to clasp her to her own bosom and call her sister. She doubted the woman felt so toward her either, though in fact she might not even have noticed Rachel yet, let alone have conclusions about her. Denny let go of the woman and stood back, though from the look on his glowing face he could hardly bear not to touch her.
Dorothea, he said, whatever does the...
But he was forestalled. The young woman,
She was very pretty, Rachel saw now, stepped back, and dropped her elegant ermine cloak on the floor with a soft thud. Rachel blinked. The young woman was wearing a sack. No other word for it, though now she looked, she perceived that it had sleeves. It was made of some coarse grey fabric, though, and hung from the young woman's shoulders, barely touching her body elsewhere.
"I will be a Quaker, Denny," she said, lifting her chin a little. "I have made up my mind."
Denny's face twitched, and Rachel thought he couldn't make up his own mind whether to laugh, cry, or cover his beloved with her cloak again. Not liking to see the lovely thing lie disregarded on the floor, Rachel bent and picked it up herself.
"The Dorothea," he said, helpless. "Is thee sure of this? I think thee knows nothing of friends."
"Certainly I do. You, thee I mean, see God in all men, seek peace in God, abjure violence, and wear dull clothes so as not to distract your minds with the vain things of the world."
"Is that not right?" Dorothea inquired anxiously.
"Lady Dorothea," Rachel corrected herself.
William had said his uncle was a duke.
"Well,
more or less, yes," Denny said, his lips twitching as he looked her up and down.
"Did thee make that garment?"
"Yes, of course. Is something wrong with it?"
"Oh, no,"
he said, sounding somewhat strangled.
Dorothea looked sharply at him, then at Rachel, suddenly seeming to notice her.
"What's wrong with it?"
she appealed to Rachel, and Rachel saw the pulse beating in her round white throat.
"Nothing," she said, fighting her own urge to laugh. "Friends are allowed to wear clothes that fit, though. Thee need not purposefully uglify thyself, I mean." "Oh, I see."
Lady Dorothea gazed thoughtfully at Rachel's tidy skirt and jacket, which might be of butternut homespun, but most assuredly fit well, and became her too, if she did say so.
"Well, that's good then," Lady Dorothea said. "I'll just take it in a bit here and there."
Dismissing this, she stepped forward again and took Denny's hands in her own.
"Denny," she said softly. "Oh, Denny, I thought I should never see you again."
"I thought so too," he said.
And Rachel saw a new struggle taking place in his face, one between duty and desire, and her heart ached for him.
"Dorothea, thee cannot stay here.
Thy uncle, he doesn't know I've gone out." "I'll go back," Dorothea assured him, "once we've settled things between us."
"Settled things," he repeated,
and with a noticeable effort withdrew his hands from hers.
"Thee means..."
"Will thee take a little wine?"
Rachel broke in, reaching for the decanter the servant had left for them.
"Yes, thank you."
"He'll have some too," Dorothea said, smiling at Rachel. "I expect he will need it," Rachel murmured with a glance at her brother. "Dorothea," Denny said helplessly, running a hand through his hair. "I know what thee means, but it is not only a matter of thee becoming a friend, always assuming that to be possible."
She drew herself up, proud as a duchess.
"Do you doubt my conviction, Denzel Hunter?"
Not exactly. I just think that perhaps thee has not given the matter sufficient thought."
"That's what you think."
A flush rose in Lady Dorothea's cheeks and she glared at Denny.
"I'll have you, thee I mean, know that I've done nothing but think ever since you left London. How the devil do you, thee, think I bloody got here?"
"Thee conspired to have thy brother shot in the abdomen?" Denny inquired. "That seems somewhat ruthless and perhaps not certain of success."
Lady Dorothea drew two or three long breaths in through her nose, eyeing him.
"Now you see," she said, in a reasonable tone of voice, "was I not quite the perfect Quaker, I would strike you. Thee. But I have not, have I? Thank you, my dear," she said to Rachel, taking a glass of wine. "You are his sister, I collect."
"Thee has not," Denny admitted warily, ignoring Rachel. "But even allowing for the sake of argument," he added, with a glimmer of his usual self, "that God has indeed spoken to thee and said that thee must join us, That still leaves a small matter of thy family.
There is nothing in your principles of faith that requires me to have my father's permission to marry, she snapped. I asked.
Denny blinked.
Who?
Priscilla Unwin. She's a Quaker I know in London. You know her too, I think. She said you'd...
Thee'd? That can't be right.
That you'd lanced a boil on her little brother's bum.
At this point, Denny became aware, perhaps because his eyes were sticking out of his head looking at Lady Dorothea, Rachel thought, not altogether amused, that his spectacles were missing. He put out a finger to push them up the bridge of his nose, then stopped and looked about, squinting. With a sigh, Rachel stepped forward and settled them onto his nose. Then she picked up the second glass of wine and handed it to him.
She's right, she told him. Thee needs it.
Plainly, Lady Dorothea said, we are getting nowhere.
She didn't look like a woman accustomed to getting nowhere, Rachel thought, but was keeping a fair grip on her temper. On the other hand, she wasn't even close to giving in to Denny's urging that she must go back to her uncle's house.
I'm not going back, she said, in a reasonable tone of voice, because if I do, you'll sneak off to the Continental Army in Valley Forge, where you think I won't follow you.
They would not, surely, Denny said.
And Rachel thought she divined a thread of hope in the question, but she wasn't sure what kind of hope it was. Lady Dorothea fixed him with a wide blue stare.
I have followed thee across an entire bloody ocean. You, thee, think a damned army can stop me?
Denny rubbed a knuckle down the bridge of his nose.
No, he admitted, I don't. That is why I have not left. I do not wish thee to follow me.
Lady Dorothea swallowed audibly, but bravely kept her chin up.
Why?
She said, and her voice shook only a little.
Why do you not wish me to follow you?
Dorothea, he said, as gently as possible. Putting aside the fact that thy going with me would put thee in rebellion and in conflict with thy family, it is an army. Moreover, it is a very poor army, and one lacking every conceivable comfort, including clothing, bedding, shoes, and food. Beyond that, it is an army on the verge of disaster and defeat. It is no place for you.
And it is a fit place for your sister?
Indeed it is not, he said, but...
He stopped short, obviously realizing that he was on the verge of stepping into a trap.
But thee can't stop me coming with thee. Rachel sprang it for him sweetly.
She wasn't quite sure she should help this strange woman, but she did admire Lady Dorothea's spirit.
And you can't stop me either, Dorothea said firmly.
Denny rubbed three fingers hard between his brows, closing his eyes as though in pain.
Dorothea, he said, dropping his hand and drawing himself up. I am called to do what I do, and it is the Lord's business and mine. Rachel comes with me not only because she is pig-headed, but also because she is my responsibility. She has no other place to go.
I do too, Rachel said hotly. Thee said thee would find me a place of safety with friends if I wanted. I didn't, and I don't.
Before Denny could come back with anything else, Lady Dorothea held out her hand in a dramatic gesture of command, stopping him dead.
I have an idea, she said.
I greatly fear to ask what it is,
Denny said, sounding entirely sincere.
I don't, Rachel said. What?
Dorothea looked from one to the other.
I have been to a Quaker meeting. Two, in fact. I know how it's done. Let us hold a meeting and ask the Lord to guide us.
Denny's mouth fell open, greatly entertaining Rachel, who was seldom able to dumbfound her brother, but was beginning to enjoy seeing Dorothea do it.
That, he began, sounding stunned, is an excellent idea, Rachel said, already dragging another chair near to the fire.
Denny could hardly argue. Looking remarkably discombobulated, he sat, though Rachel noticed that he put her between Dorothea and himself. She wasn't sure whether he was afraid to be too close to Dorothea,
lest the power of her presence overwhelm him, or whether it was only that sitting across the hearth from her gave him the best view. They all settled slowly, shifting a bit for comfort, and lapsed into silence. Rachel closed her eyes, seeing the warm redness of the fire inside her lids, feeling the comfort of it on her hands and feet. She gave silent thanks for it, remembering the constant griping of cold in the camp, the nails of her fingers and toes on fire with it, and the continual shivering that lessened but didn't stop when she huddled into her blankets at night and left her muscles fatigued and sore. It was no wonder Denny didn't want Dorothea to go with them. She didn't want to go back, would give almost anything not to go, anything but Denny's well-being. She hated being cold and hungry, but it would be much worse to be warm and well-fed and know that he suffered alone. Did Lady Dorothea have any idea what it would be like, she wondered, and opened her eyes. Dorothea sat straight but upright, graceful hands folded in her lap. She supposed Denny was imagining, as Rachel was, those hands reddened and marred by chilblains, that lovely face gaunt with hunger and blotched with dirt and cold. Dorothea's eyes were shadowed by her lids, but Rachel was sure she was looking at Denny. This was a considerable gamble on Dorothea's part, she thought. For what if the Lord spoke to Denny and said it was impossible, that he must send her away? What if the Lord spoke to Dorothea now, she thought suddenly, or what if he had already? Rachel was quite taken aback at the thought. It wasn't that friends thought that the Lord spoke only to them. It was only that they weren't sure other folk listened very often. Had she been listening herself? In all honesty, she was forced to admit that she hadn't. And she knew why, out of a disinclination to hear what she was afraid she must, that she must turn away from Ian Murray and abandon the thoughts of him that warmed her body and heated her dreams in the freezing forest. So she woke sometimes sure that if she put out her hand to the falling snow, it would hiss and vanish from her palm. She swallowed hard and closed her eyes, trying to open herself to the truth, but trembling in fear of hearing it. All she heard, though, was a steady panting noise, and an instant later, Rollo's wet nose nudged her hand. Disconcerted, she scratched his ears. Surely it wasn't seemly to be doing that in meeting. But he would keep nudging her until she complied, she knew. He half closed his yellow eyes in pleasure and rested his heavy head upon her knee. The dog loves him, she thought, rubbing gently through the thick, coarse fur. Can he be a bad man if that is so? It wasn't God she heard reply, but her brother, who would certainly say, "While dogs are worthy creatures, I think they are perhaps no judge of character." But I am, she thought to herself. I know what he is, and I know him for what he might be, too. She looked at Dorothea, motionless in her grey bag of a dress. Lady Dorothea Grey was prepared to abandon her former life, and very likely her family, to become a friend for Denny's sake. Might it not be, she wondered, that Ian Murray could turn from violence for hers? Well, there is a proud thought, she scolded herself. What sort of power does thee think thee has, Rachel Mary Hunter? No one has that sort of power, save the Lord. But the Lord did have it, and if the Lord should be so inclined, anything was possible. Rollo's tail moved gently, thumping thrice upon the floor. Denzel Hunter straightened a little on his stool. It was the slightest movement, but coming as it did out of utter stillness, it surprised both the women, who lifted their heads like startled birds. "I love thee, Dorothea," he said. He spoke very quietly, but his soft eyes burned behind his spectacles, and Rachel felt her chest ache. "Will thee marry me?" Chapter 87 Severance and Reunion, April the 20th, 1778.
As transatlantic voyages went, and after our adventures with Captains Roberts, Hickman, and Stebbings, I considered myself something of a connoisseur of seagoing disaster, the trip to America was quite dull. We did have a slight brush with an English man-o'-war, but fortunately outran her, did run into two squalls and a major storm, but luckily didn't sink. And while the food was execrable, I was much too distracted to do more than knock weevils out of the biscuit before eating it. Half my mind was on the future, Massali and Fergus's precarious situation, the danger of Henri Christian's condition, and the logistics of dealing with it. The other half, well, to be fair, 7/8, was still at Lallybroch with Jamie. I felt raw and bruised, severed in some vital part, as always when parted from Jamie for very long, but also as though I had been violently ejected from my home, like a barnacle ripped from its rock and heedlessly tossed into boiling surf. The greater part of that, I thought, was Ian's impending death. Ian was so much a part of Lallybroch, his presence there so much a constant and a comfort to Jamie all these years, that the sense of his loss was, in a way, the loss of Lallybroch itself. Oddly enough, Jenny's words, hurtful as they might have been, didn't really trouble me. I knew only too well the frantic grief, the desperation that one turned to rage because it was the only way to stay alive. And in truth, I understood her feelings too, because I shared them. Irrational or not, I felt I should have been able to help Ian. What good was all my knowledge, all my skill, if I couldn't help when help was truly vital? But there was a further sense of loss, and a further nagging guilt, in the fact that I couldn't be there when Ian died, that I had had to leave him for the last time, knowing that I wouldn't see him again, unable to offer comfort to him, or to be with Jamie or his family when the blow fell, or even simply to bear witness to his passing. Young Ian felt this too, to an even greater degree. I often found him sitting near the stern, staring into the ship's wake with troubled eyes.
"Do you think he's gone yet?" he asked me abruptly on one occasion when I'd come to sit beside him there. "Da."
"I don't know," I told him honestly. "I'd think so, on the basis of how ill he was. But people do sometimes hang on amazingly. When is his birthday, do you know?" He stared at me in bafflement.
"It's in May sometime, near Uncle Jimmy's."
"Why?" I shrugged and pulled my shawl tighter against the chill of the wind. "Often people who are very ill, but are near their birthday, seem to wait until it's past before dying. I read a study of it once. For some reason, it's more likely if the person is famous or well-known." That made him laugh, though painfully.
"Da's never been that,"
he sighed.
"Right now I wish I'd stayed for him. I know he said to go, and I wanted to go," he added fairly, "but I feel bad that I did."
I sighed too.
"So do I." "But you had to go," he protested. "You couldn't have let poor wee Henri Christian choke. Dad would understand that. I knew he did."
I smiled at his earnest attempt to make me feel better. "He understood why you needed to go too."
"Aye, I know."
He was silent for a bit, watching the furrow of the wake. It was a brisk day, and the ship was travelling well, though the sea was choppy, dotted with whitecaps. "I wish," he said suddenly, then stopped and swallowed.
"I wish Da could have met Rachel," he said, low-voiced. "I wish she could meet him."
I made a sympathetic sound. I remembered all too vividly the years during which I had watched Brianna grow, aching because she would never know her father. And then a miracle had happened. But it wouldn't happen for Ian. "I know you told your Da about Rachel. He told me you had, and was so happy to know about her." That made him smile a little.
"Did you tell Rachel about your father, your family?"
"No," he sounded startled.
"No, I never did."
"Well, you'll just have to." "What's wrong?" His brow had furrowed and his mouth turned down.
I
Nothing, really. It's only... I just thought... I never told her anything. I mean, we didn't really talk, eh? I mean, I said things to her now and then, and her me. But just in the ordinary way of things. And then we... I kissed her. And, well, that was all about it. He made a helpless gesture. But I never asked her. I was just sure. And now you're not?
He shook his head, brown hair flying in the wind.
Oh, no, Auntie. I'm as sure of what's between us as I am of...
He looked about in search of some symbol of solidity on the heaving deck, but then gave up.
Well, I'm surer of how I feel than I am that the sun will come up tomorrow.
I'm sure she knows that.
Aye, she does, he said in a softer voice. I know she does.
We sat for a bit in silence. Then I stood up and said,
Well, in that case,
perhaps you ought to say a prayer for your father, and then go and sit near the bow. I had been in Philadelphia once or twice in the 20th century for medical conferences. I hadn't liked the place then, finding it grubby and unwelcoming. It was different now, but not much more attractive. The roads that weren't cobbled were seas of mud, and streets that would eventually be lined with run-down row houses with yards full of rubbish, broken plastic toys, and motorcycle parts, were now edged with ramshackle shanties with yards full of rubbish, discarded oyster shells, and tethered goats. Granted, there were no black-suited feral policemen visible, but the petty criminals were still the same and still visible, despite the very obvious presence of the British Army. Redcoats swarmed near the taverns, and marching columns went past the wagon, muskets on their shoulders. It was spring. I'd give it that much. There were trees everywhere, thanks to William Penn's dictum that 1 acre in 5 should be left in trees. Even the avaricious politicians of the 20th century hadn't quite succeeded in deforesting the place, though probably only because they couldn't figure out how to make a profit at it without being caught. And many of the trees were in bloom, a confetti of white petals drifting over the horses' backs as the wagon turned into the city proper. An army patrol was set up on the main road into the city. They had stopped us, demanding passes from the driver and his 2 male passengers. I had put on a proper cap, didn't meet anyone's eye, and murmured that I was coming in from the country to tend my daughter who was about to give birth. The soldiers glanced briefly into the large basket of food I had on my lap, but didn't even look at my face before waving the wagon on. Respectability had its uses. I wondered idly how many spy masters had thought of using elderly ladies. You didn't hear about old women as spies, but then again, that might merely indicate how good they were at it. Fergus's print shop was not in the most fashionable district, but not far off, and I was pleased to see that it was a substantial red brick building, standing in a row of solid, pleasant-looking houses like it. We had not written ahead to say I was coming. I would have arrived as soon as the letter. With a rising heart, I opened the door. Masali was standing at the counter, sorting stacks of paper. She glanced up as the bell above the door rang, blinked, then gaped at me. How are you, dear? I said, and putting down the basket, hurried to put up the flap of the counter and take her in my arms. She looked like death warmed over, though her eyes lit with a passionate relief upon seeing me. She nearly fell into my arms and burst into uncharacteristic sobs. I patted her back, making soothing sounds, and feeling somewhat alarmed. Her clothes hung limp on her bones, and she smelled stale, her hair unwashed for too long. "It'll be all right," I repeated firmly for the dozenth time. And she stopped sobbing and stood back a bit, groping in her pocket for a grubby handkerchief. To my shock, I saw that she was pregnant again. "Where's Fergus?" I asked.
"A dinner, Ken."
"He's left you," I blurted out, horrified. "Why, that wretched little..." "No, no," she said hurriedly, almost laughing through her tears. "He's not left me, not at all. It's only he's in hiding. He changes his place every few days, and I dinna ken just which one he's in right now. The Waynes will find him."
Why is he in hiding?
Not that I need to ask, I suppose, I said, with a glance at the squat black printing press that stood behind the counter. Anything specific, though?
Aye. A wee pamphlet for Mr. Peen.
He's got a series of them going, Ken, called The American Crisis.
Mr. Payne? The common sense fellow? Aye, that's him, she said, sniffing and dabbing.
He's a nice man, but you dinna want to drink with him, Fergus says.
Ken, how some men are sweet and loving when they're drunk, but some get foo and it's up wi' the bonnets of Bonnie Dundee and them not even Scots for an excuse.
Oh, that sort. Yes, I know it well.
How far along are you? I asked, changing the subject back to one of general interest. Shouldn't you sit down?
You oughtn't to be on your feet for a long time.
How far? She looked surprised and put a hand involuntarily where I was looking, to her slightly swollen stomach. Then she laughed. Oh, that! She burrowed under her apron and removed a bulging leather sack she had tied around her waist. For escaping, she explained, in case they fire the house and I have to make a run for it wi' the weans. The sack was surprisingly heavy when I took it from her, and I heard a muffled clicking down at the bottom, beneath the layer of papers and children's small toys. The Caslon Italic 24? I asked, and she smiled, shedding at least 10 years on the spot. All except X. I had to hammer that one back into a lump and trade it to a goldsmith for enough money for food after Fergus left. There's still an X in there, mind, she said, taking back the bag. But that one's real lead.
Did you have to use the Gaudi Bold 10?
Jamie and Fergus had cast 2 full sets of type from gold, these rubbed in soot and covered with ink until they were indistinguishable from the many sets of genuine lead type in the type case that stood demurely against the wall behind the press. She shook her head and reached to take the bag back again. Fergus took that wi' him. He meant to bury it somewhere safe just in case. You look fair fast wi' travel, Mother Clare, she went on, leaning forward to peer at me. Will I send Joni down to the ordinary for a jug of cider?
That would be wonderful, I said, still reeling a little from the revelations of the last few minutes. Henri Christian, though, how is he? Is he here?
Out back wi' his friend, I think, she said, rising. I'll call him in. He's that wee bit tired, poor mite, from not sleeping well. And he's got such a throat he sounds like a costive bullfrog.
Doesn't it dampen him much, though, I'll tell you that.
She smiled, despite her tiredness, and went through the door into the living quarters, calling, Henri Christian, as she went.
In case they fire the house. Who, I wondered, feeling a chill.
The British Army? Loyalists? And however was she managing, running a business and a family alone, with a husband in hiding and a sick child who couldn't be left alone while he slept? The horror of our situation, she'd said in her letter to Lyra. And that had been months ago, when Fergus was still at home. Well, she wasn't alone now. For the first time since I'd left Jamie in Scotland, I felt something more than the pull of grim necessity in my situation. I'd write to him this evening, I decided. He might, I hoped he would, leave Lallybroch before my letter reached him there. But if so, Jenny and the rest of the family would be glad to know what was going on here. And if by chance Ian was still alive. But I didn't want to think of that. Knowing that his death meant Jamie's release to come to me made me feel like a ghoul, as though I wished for his death to come sooner. Though in all honesty, I thought Ian himself might wish it to be sooner rather than later. These morbid thoughts were interrupted by Massali's return, Henri Christian scampering beside her.
Grand-mère, he shouted, seeing me and leapt into my arms, nearly knocking me over.
He was a very solid little boy. He nuzzled me affectionately, and I felt a remarkable rush of warm joy at seeing him. I kissed and hugged him fiercely, feeling the hole left in my heart by Mandy and Jem's departure fill up a bit. Isolated from Massali's family in Scotland, I had nearly forgotten that I still had 4 lovely grandchildren left, and was grateful to be reminded of it.
Want to see a trick, grand-mère?
Henri Christian croaked eagerly. Massali was right. He did sound like a constipated bullfrog. I nodded, though, and hopping off my lap, he pulled three small leather bags stuffed with bran out of his pocket and began at once to juggle them with amazing dexterity.
Has Da taught him? Massali said, with a certain amount of pride.
When I'm big, like Germain, Da will teach me to pick pockets, too.
Massali gasped and clapped a hand over his mouth. Henri Christian, we dinna ever speak of that, she said sternly. Not to anybody. Do you hear? He glanced at me, bewildered, but nodded obediently. The chill I had felt earlier returned. Was Germain picking pockets professionally, so to speak? I looked at Massali, but she shook her head slightly. We'd talk about it later.
Open your mouth and stick out your tongue, sweetheart, I suggested to Henri Christian. Let Granny see your sore throat. It sounds very ouchy.
I'll goggle,
he said, grinning widely but obligingly opened up. A faint putrid smell wafted out of his wide-opened mouth, and even lacking a lighted scope, I could see that the swollen tonsils nearly obstructed his throat altogether. Goodness gracious, I said, turning his head to and fro to get a better view. I'm amazed that he can eat, let alone sleep. Sometimes he can't, Massali said, and I heard the strain in her voice. Often enough he canna manage to swallow anything but a bit of milk, and even that's like knives in his throat, poor bairn. She crouched beside me, smoothing the fine dark hair off Henri Christian's flushed face. Can you help, do you think, Mother Claire?
Oh, yes, I said, with much more confidence than I actually felt. Absolutely.
I felt the tension drain out of her like water, and, as though it were a literal draining, tears began to run quietly down her face. She pulled Henri Christian's head into her bosom so he couldn't see her cry, and I reached out to embrace both of them, laying my cheek against her capped head, smelling the stale, musky tang of her terror and exhaustion. It's all right now, I said softly, rubbing her thin back. I'm here. You can sleep. Massali slept the rest of the day and all through the night. I was tired from the journey, but managed to doze in the big chair by the kitchen fire, Henri Christian cradled in my lap, snoring heavily. He did stop breathing twice during the night, and while I got him started again with no difficulty, I could see that something had to be done at once. Consequently, I had a brief nap in the morning, and having washed my face and eaten a bit, went out in search of what I'd need. I had the most rudimentary of medical instruments with me, but the fact was, tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy didn't really require anything complex in that line. I wished that Ian had come into the city with me. I could have used his help, and so could Massali. But it was dangerous for a man of his age. He couldn't enter the city openly without being stopped and questioned by British patrols, likely arrested as a suspicious character, which he most assuredly was. Beyond that, he'd been afire to look for Rachel Hunter. The task of finding two people and a dog, who might be almost anywhere between Canada and Charleston, with no means of communication other than the foot and the spoken word, would have daunted anyone less stubborn than a person of Fraser blood. Agreeable as he might be, though, Ian was as capable as Jamie of pursuing a chosen course, come hell, high water, or reasonable suggestions. He did, as he pointed out, have one advantage. Denny Hunter was presumably still an army surgeon. If so, he was obviously with the Continental Army, some part of the Continental Army. So Ian's notion was to discover where the closest part of the army might be just now, and begin his inquiries there. To which end, he proposed to skulk around the edges of Philadelphia, creeping into taverns and shebeens on the outskirts, and, by means of local gossip, discover where some part of the army presently was. The most I'd been able to persuade him to do was to send word to Fergus's print shop, telling us where he was bound, once he discovered anything that gave him a possible destination. In the meantime, all I could do was say a quick prayer to his guardian angel, a most overworked being, then have a word with my own, whom I envisioned as a sort of grandmotherly shape with an anxious expression, and set about doing what I'd come to do. I now walked through the muddy streets, pondering the procedure. I had done a tonsillectomy only once, well, twice if you counted the Beardsley twins separately, in the last 10 years. It was normally a straightforward, quick procedure, but then again it wasn't normally performed in a gloomy print shop on a dwarf with a constricted airway, a sinus infection, and a peritonsillar abscess. Still, I needn't do it in the print shop if I could find a better lighted place. Where would that be? I wondered. A rich person's house, most likely, one where candle wax was squandered profligately. I'd been in many such houses, particularly during our time in Paris, but knew no one even moderately well-to-do in Philadelphia. Neither did Massali. I'd asked. Well, one thing at a time. Before I worried any more about an operating theatre, I needed to find a blacksmith capable of fine work to make the wire loop instrument I required. I could, in a pinch, cut the tonsils with a scalpel, but it would be more than difficult to remove the adenoids located above the soft palate that way. And the last thing I wanted was to be slicing and poking round in Henri Christian's severely inflamed throat in the dark with a sharp instrument. The wire loop would be sharp enough, but was unlikely to damage anything it bumped into. Only the edge surrounding the tissue to be removed would cut. And then, only when I made the forceful scooping motion that would sever a tonsil or adenoid neatly. I wondered uneasily whether he had a strep infection. His throat was bright red, but other infections could cause that. No, we'd have to take our chances with the strep, I thought. I had set some penicillin bowls to brew almost the moment I arrived. There was no way of telling whether the extract I might get from them in a few days was active or not, nor, if it was, just how active. But it was better than nothing, and so was I. I did have one undeniably useful thing, or would if this afternoon's quest was successful. Nearly 5 years ago, Lord John Grey had sent me a glass bottle of vitriol, and the pelican glassware necessary to distill ether using it. He'd procured those items from an apothecary in Philadelphia, I thought, though I couldn't recall the name. But there couldn't be many apothecaries in Philadelphia, and I proposed to visit all of them until I found what I was looking for. Massali had said there were two large apothecary shops in town, and only a large one would have what I needed to make ether. What was the name of the gentleman from whom Lord John Grey had acquired my pelican apparatus? Was he in Philadelphia at all? My mind was a blank, either from fatigue or from simple forgetfulness. The time when I had made ether in my surgery on Fraser's Ridge seemed as distant and mythical as Noah's flood. I found the first apothecary and got from him some useful items, including a jar of leeches, though I boggled a little at the thought of putting one inside Henri Christian's mouth. What if he managed to swallow the thing? On the other hand, I reflected, he was a 4-year-old boy with a very imaginative elder brother. He'd probably swallowed much worse things than a leech. With luck, though, I wouldn't need them. I had also got 2 cautery irons, very small ones. It was a primitive and painful way of stopping bleeding, but in fact, very effective. The apothecary had not had any vitriol, though. He had apologized for the lack, saying that such things must be imported from England, and with the war. I thanked him and went on to the second place, where I was informed that they had had some vitriol, but had sold it some time previous to an English lord, though what he wanted was such a thing the man behind the counter couldn't begin to imagine. An English lord? I said, surprised. Surely it couldn't be Lord John. Though, come to that, it wasn't as though the English aristocracy was flocking to Philadelphia these days, save those members who were soldiers. And the man had said, a lord, not a major or a captain. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. I asked, and was obligingly told that it was a Lord John Grey, and that he had requested the vitriol to be delivered to his house on Chestnut Street. Feeling a little like Alice down the rabbit hole, I was still a bit light-headed from lack of sleep and the fatigues of the journey from Scotland, I asked the way to Chestnut Street. The door to the house was opened by an extraordinarily beautiful young woman dressed in a fashion that made it clear she was no servant. We blinked at each other in surprise. She plainly hadn't been expecting me either. But when I inquired for Lord John, saying I was an old acquaintance, she readily invited me in, saying that her uncle would be back directly. He had only taken a horse to be shod. "You would think he'd send the boy," the young woman, who gave her name as Lady Dorothea Grey, said apologetically, "or my cousin. But Uncle John is most particular about his horses." "Your cousin?" I asked, my slow mind tracing the possible family connections. "You don't mean William Ransom, do you?"
"Ellesmere, yes," she said, looking surprised but pleased. "Do you know him?"
"We've met once or twice," I said.
"If you don't mind my asking, how does he come to be in Philadelphia?
I had understood that he was paroled with the rest of Burgoyne's army and had gone to Boston in order to sail home to England."
"Oh, he is," she said. "Paroled, I mean. He came here, though, first, to see his father. That's Uncle John. And my brother."
Her large blue eyes clouded a little at the mention.
"Henry's very ill, I'm afraid."
"I'm so sorry to hear it," I said, sincerely but briefly. I was much more interested in William's presence here, but before I could ask anything further, there was a quick light step on the porch, and the front door opened.
"Dotty," said a familiar voice, "have you any idea where—" "Oh, I beg your pardon."
Lord John Grey had come into the parlour and stopped seeing me. Then he actually saw me, and his jaw dropped.
"How nice to see you again," I said pleasantly. "But I'm sorry to hear that your nephew is ill."
"Thank you," he said, and eyeing me rather warily, bowed low over my hand, kissing it gracefully.
"I am delighted to see you again, Mrs. Fraser," he added, sounded as though he actually meant it. He hesitated for a moment, but of course couldn't help asking. "Your husband?"
"He's in Scotland," I said, feeling rather mean at disappointing him. It flickered across his face, but was promptly erased. He was a gentleman and a soldier. In fact, he was wearing an army uniform, which rather surprised me.
"You've returned to active duty, then?" I asked, raising my brows at him.
"Not exactly. Dotty, have you not called for Mrs. Fig yet? I'm sure Mrs. Fraser would like some refreshment."
"I'd only just come," I said hastily, as Dotty leapt up and went out.
"Indeed," he said, courteously repressing the "why?" that showed plainly on his face. He motioned me to a chair and sat down himself, wearing a rather odd expression, as though trying to think how to say something awkward.
"I am delighted to see you," he said again, slowly. "Did you—" "I do not wish to sound in any way ungracious, Mrs. Fraser. You must excuse me, but did you come to bring me a message from your husband, perhaps?"
He couldn't help the small light that sprang up in his eyes, and I felt almost apologetic as I shook my head. "I'm sorry," I said, and was surprised to find that I meant it. "I've come to beg a favour, not on my own behalf, for my grandson."
He blinked at that. "Your grandson?" he repeated blankly. "I thought that your daughter—" "Oh, of course. I was forgetting that your husband's foster son, his family, is here. It is one of his children?"
"Yes, that's right."
Without more ado, I explained the situation, describing Henri Christian's state and reminding him of his generosity in sending me the vitriol and glass apparatus more than 4 years before.
"Mr. Sholto, the apothecary on Walnut Street, told me that he had sold you a large bottle of vitriol some months ago. I wondered, do you by any chance still have it?" I made no effort to keep the eagerness out of my voice, and his expression softened.
"Yes, I do," he said,
and to my surprise, smiled like the sun coming out from behind a cloud.
"I bought it for you, Mrs. Fraser."
A bargain was struck at once. He would not only give me the vitriol, but also purchase any other medical supplies I might require if I would consent to perform surgery on his nephew.
Dr. Hunter removed one of the balls at Christmas, he said, and that improved Henry's condition somewhat. The other remains embedded, though, and...
Dr. Hunter? I interrupted him. Not Denzel Hunter, you don't mean?
I do mean that, he said, surprised and frowning a little. You do not mean to say you know him.
I do indeed mean that, I said, smiling. We work together often, both at Ticonderoga and at Saratoga with Gates' army. But what is he doing in Philadelphia?
He began,
but was interrupted by the sound of light footsteps coming down the stair. I had been vaguely conscious of footsteps overhead as we talked, but had paid no attention. I looked toward the doorway now, though, and my heart leapt at the sight of Rachel Hunter, who was standing in it, staring at me with her mouth in a perfect O of astonishment. The next moment she was in my arms, hugging me fit to break my ribs.
"Friend Claire," she said, letting go at last. "I never thought to see... That is, I'm so pleased. Oh, Claire, Ian, has he come back with thee?"
Her face was alive with eagerness and fear, hope and wariness chasing each other like racing clouds across her features. "He has," I assured her.
"He is not here, though."
Her face fell. "Oh," she said in a small voice.
"Where?" "He's gone to look for you," I said gently, taking her hands.
Joy blazed up in her eyes like a forest fire.
"Oh,"
she said in a completely different voice.
"Oh!"
Lord John coughed politely.
"Perhaps it would be unwise for me to know exactly where your nephew is, Mrs. Fraser," he observed, "as I assume he shares your husband's principles." "Just so. If you will excuse me, then, I will go and tell Henry of your arrival. I suppose you wish to examine him."
"Oh," I said, recalled suddenly to the matter at hand. "Yes, yes, of course, if you wouldn't mind." He smiled, glancing at Rachel, whose face had gone white at seeing me, but who was now the shade of a russet apple with excitement.
"Not at all," he said. "Come upstairs when you are at leisure, Mrs. Fraser. I'll wait for you there."
Chapter 88. Rather messy. I missed Brianna all the time, in greater or lesser degree, depending upon the circumstance. But I missed her most particularly now. She could, I was sure, have solved the problem of getting light down Henri Christian's throat. I had him laid on a table at the front of the print shop now, taking every advantage of such light as came in there. But this was Philadelphia, not New Bern. If the sky wasn't overcast with clouds, it was hazed with smoke from the city's chimneys. And the street was narrow. The buildings opposite blocked most of what light there was. Not that it mattered that much, I told myself. The room could have been blazing with sun, and I still couldn't have seen a thing in the inner reaches of Henri Christian's throat. Massali had a small mirror with which to direct light, and that would perhaps help with the tonsils. The adenoids would have to be done by touch. I could feel the soft, spongy edge of one adenoid just behind the soft palate. It took shape in my mind as I carefully fitted the wire loop around it, handling it with great delicacy so as not to let the edge cut either my fingertips or the body of the swollen adenoid. There was going to be a gush of blood when I sliced through it. I had Henri Christian braced at an angle, Massali holding his inert body almost on its side. Denzel Hunter kept his head steady, clamping the pad soaked in ether firmly over his nose. I had no means of suction other than my own mouth. I'd have to turn him quickly after I made the cut and let the blood run out of his mouth before it ran down his throat and choked him. The tiny cautery iron was heating, its spade-shaped tip thrust into a pan of hot coals. That might be the trickiest part, I thought, pausing to steady myself and steady Massali with a nod. I didn't want to burn his tongue or the inside of his mouth, and it would be slippery. I twisted the handle sharply, and the little body jerked under my hand. "Hold him tight," I said calmly. "A little more ether, please." Masali's breath was coming hard, and her knuckles were as white as her face. I felt the adenoid separate cleanly, come adrift, and scooped it between my fingers, pulling it out of his throat before it could slip down into his esophagus. Tilted his head quickly to the side, smelling the sheared metal smell of hot blood. I dropped the severed bit of tissue into a pan and nodded to Rachel, who pulled the cautery iron from its coals and put it carefully into my hand. I still had my other hand in his mouth, keeping the tongue and uvula out of the way, a finger on the site of the X-adenoid marking my place. The cautery iron seared a white line of pain down my finger as I slid it down his throat, and I let out a small hiss, but didn't move my finger. The scorched scent of burning blood and tissue came hot and thick, and Masali made a small frantic noise, but didn't loosen her hold on her son's body. "It is well, friend Masali," Rachel whispered to her, clasping her shoulder. "He breathes well. He is not in pain. He is held in the light. He will do well."
"Yes, he will," I said. "Take the iron now, Rachel, if you will. Dip the loop in the whiskey, please, and give me that again. One down, three to go."
"I have never seen anything like it," Denzel Hunter said, for perhaps the fifth time. He looked from the pad of fabric in his hand to Henri Christian, who was beginning to stir and whimper in his mother's arms.
"I should not have believed it, Claire, had I not seen it with my own eyes."
"Well, I thought you'd better see it," I said, wiping sweat from my face with a handkerchief. A sense of profound well-being filled me. The surgery had been fast, no more than 5 or 6 minutes, and Henri Christian was already coughing and crying, coming out of the ether. Germaine, Joni, and Félicité all watched wide-eyed from the doorway into the kitchen, Germaine keeping tight hold of his sister's hands. "I'll teach you to make it, if you like." His face, already shining with happiness at the successful surgery, lit up at this.
"Oh, Claire, such a gift! To be able to cut without giving pain, to keep a patient quite still without restraint, it is unimaginable."
"Well, it's a long way from perfect," I warned him. "And it's very dangerous, both to make and to use." I distilled the ether the day before out in the woodshed. It was a very volatile compound, and there was a better than even chance that it would explode and burn the shed down, killing me in the process. All had gone well, though the thought of doing it again made me feel rather hollow and sweaty-palmed. I lifted the dropping bottle and shook it gently, more than 3/4 full, and I had another, slightly larger bottle as well.
"Will it be enough, does thee think?" Denny asked, realizing what I was thinking.
"It depends on what we find."
Henri Christian's surgery, despite the technical difficulties, had been very simple. Henry Gray's wouldn't be. I had examined him, Denzel beside me, to explain what he had seen and done during the earlier surgery, which had